This is tape recording number 554C13PLS. The title of this lecture is The Eight Dynamics. Copyright 1955 by L. Ron Hubbard. All world performance rights reserved. Re-recorded by HCO St. Hill Tape Department.
I haven't got very much to talk to you about tonight. But I'll think of something. For any newcomer in the audience, these talks are sponsored by the Hubbard Dianetic Research Foundation, Hubbard Association of Scientologists International, and they concern answers on the subject of human behavior and the resolution of some of the problems of human behavior. There are a great many things in these two sciences of Dianetics and Scientology which resolve problems heretofore unresolved. The more ordinary of these problems is the matter of IQ. Everyone knows that intelligence is intelligence, and one has that intelligence, and that's that. Almost daily at the HASI clinic, we disprove this. Daily. People who come there for a week quite normally gain an intelligence something on the order of 15 points. This is a tremendous jump. Even people who are in the class that would normally be considered moron and so forth gain similarly. So evidently something can be done about intelligence. So something has been done about this age-old stumbling block of human problems. How smart is a man? He's as smart as we audit him to be. That is one minor concern. Another concern, which we have resolved with considerable ease, is the problem of behavior as such. Let us take such a thing as very hypercritical conduct. An individual is in high protest in all directions against the society and his fellows so that he himself cannot sleep or rest. And he doesn't recognize that there's anything wrong with him. He thinks it's the society that is wrong, and therefore he must protest violently against it. Well, with a little bit of processing, quite ordinarily this hypercritical state gets down to something approaching a reasonable state. Well, does that mean that we process somebody into an apathy so that he can accept his environment? No. Actually, an individual who is hypercritical has usually gone below apathy already. And the problems he is screaming about are not actual, and he is just dreaming up things to scream about because he doesn't really recognize the things around him which should be remedied. Now, when an individual is in fairly good condition, those problems which he screams about are the problems he can do something about. That's quite a different type of critical behavior. Nobody says that we shouldn't be critical of the society around us, but there is so much that about which we could be critical that we consider it rather amusing, people going around being critical about hallucinatory things. And this is... you see how that sets. Well, we can do something about that, not by making the individual apathetic, but by actually pulling him into a state of action and capability. An individual stops this process of sitting back and crying about an unactual thing. You know, he's crying because all the bananas in the city are actually made out of lead. I mean, it's just as silly as that, some of the things they cry about. They sit back and they're very upset. Well, let's take the organization. They get very upset because the organization itself is doing such horrible things. Or people in the HDRF or HASI are doing such horrible things. And unspecifiably, You see, no specifications. Now, there aren't any horrible things really outlined. There are very few known. The organizations are liable to the inefficiencies to which man is generally liable. But we get this interesting state of somebody being very upset about the motives or actions and so forth of an organization which motives and actions are non-extant. Now, if they want to get upset about the organization, why, let them come around and ask somebody who's in the organization. They can show them several things that could be gotten upset about, you see. You know, there are some things in there that could be gotten upset about. But people don't get upset about these things. They get upset about imaginary things. Well, we could process, get somebody into a state where he actually could recognize what is actually wrong with the organization. See? That would be quite a gain, quite a goal. That's pretty well up. There are a lot of people in the country terribly upset about the government, and they don't know wherein. Something on the order of a preacher down south who was brought in by the elders of the church, and he came in and he gave a beautiful speech, and afterwards, why, the elders were considering hiring him as the permanent minister, and he spoke to them and asked how he got along, and they said, well, and he says, well, didn't I sound loud enough? Didn't I shout hard enough? And he said, well, didn't I argufy and sputify enough? And one of the elders, evidently with a concurrence of the others, says, well, he says, you argufied and you sputified, but you didn't show wherein. And this is analogous to condition some people about the government. You see, they say, it's all bad, and it's bad, and we're real upset. And bring them up tone scale a little bit, and they take a look at the government, and they can find some things wrong with the government. But this is the first time they've looked, you see. Most of the things being found wrong with the government aren't wrong with the government. All right, now, where else could we take this individual just on the basis of criticism? We could take him upscale to a point where he could actually recognize his role in the society and his ability to do something about the government. You see? Now, where we part company with the psychiatrist. The psychiatrist never was in company with us. We have a lot of pretty doubtful characters once in a while around, but never a psychiatrist. I mean, we don't get that low. By the way, there are some people out in California, where else, who get upset about the fact that I take slams at psychiatry and psychology. And I ask them why and so forth, and somebody in the office finally told me why. Because these people recognize that psychology and psychiatry couldn't stand up to these slams I give them, and that's the point. Now, the psychiatrist is very suspicious of somebody who's active. That's bad. Bad. Somebody is active. A fellow walks in and he says, how are you, doctor? And so forth. Immediately after this, you know, he says, good morning. It's a beautiful day. Now, let's see. What are we going to get done today? And if you were to follow right in behind him after he's left and listen to the fact, it's kind of to tell you. That manic depressive with schizoid tendencies. And you might point out to him, well, that fellow that just walked through here, executive manager of a $1 billion corporation, and everything in his entire vicinity blossoms and blooms. That just doesn't matter. Overly active. I was flat on my back one time in a hospital during the war. And a bunch of these characters come around and explain to me. I couldn't have been more emotionless. I mean, the only thing that was moving was my heart slightly. And they told me I'd have to give up this rushing around. Well, they view with great misgivings anyone who is active. And so, the normal belief in that field would be that if anyone was brought up to the level that he could actually see what was wrong and where he would do something about it, as the higher level in that, these people would say, that man would be a revolutionary. He would be overactive. And that's not true at all, because the government itself utterly depends on its having in its midst and around it enough active people who are doing something about what actually is wrong. And when a government no longer has these people in its vicinity, it is a dead government. Similarly, an individual who is not working in life to remedy or make better the actual conditions which he finds around him is not liable to succeed. And if you want a good definition of success, it would just be that, a person who can look around him and see what has to be done, what has to be remedied, what's actual, and then actually can do and does do something about it. And that person is about 84 light years above normal. So we're going pretty high. Now, there is that fellow on a harmonic, you might say, below that same level, who imagines many wrong things. He stands there, he sees a steam locomotive. It hasn't any wheels. It has no stack. It has no firebox. And its boiler is empty. And he stands there and he looks at it and gets passionate about this steam locomotive. And he says, it is the most diabolical thing in the world. Every piece of brass on that whole locomotive is trimmed with gold. What a horrible expense. You go and you look and you, one, can't find any brass. And you certainly can't find any gold. What most people do about life. They never notice the missing stacks, the missing wheels, and the empty boiler. They never notice that. They're upset about it. These are people who cannot look at a condition. They can look away from a condition and then sort of figure what the condition was. And that's a pretty hard thing to accomplish something starting from that point. We have to look around and find out what actually is wrong or is taking place. We have to be able to observe the actualities in our environment and then do something about these very actualities, not something else. So there's where criticalness leads, and there is the scale of criticalness. First, the individual, really the bottom, where the individual won't even complain about hallucinatory wrongnesses. You know, he's real apathetic. And then up above that, where the person talks about hallucinatory wrongnesses. You know, lots of things wrong, but he doesn't show wherein. And right up above that, the individual who gets the glimmering that there is something wrong and is determined to get the actual thing that is wrong. And then up above this level, the individual who can look and find the things that are wrong. And then above that, the individual who not only looks, but knows he can do something right about it. And above that, the individual who can look, see what's wrong, recognize its remedy, and act to remedy that wrongness. If you had a lot of these boys up here, you'd have a society. I mean, you think you've got a society. Now you have. Where we part company with the 19th century school of thought, as represented by psychology, is that man must adjust to his environment. Psychology said man must adjust to his environment. His whole salvation depends upon his adjusting to his environment. Well, look, if there are a lot of things wrong in that environment, and they actually are wrong, then according to psychology definition, they should also be wrong with the individual. Think that over for a moment. If everybody in his town has a broken back, then he has to have a broken back. You get this as a complete washout of the individual? Now, our view of it is an individual is as well off as he adjusts the environment to him. Completely different view. Everybody in his town's got a broken back. So then he ought to fix them up so they don't have broken backs. You get the idea? Now, we would consider that individual a healthy individual. And we would consider the individual who adjusts to his environment a sort of a hopeless thing. The whole history of man is completely dependent upon that fellow who can adjust the environment to him. Now, our departure then was a quite definite departure, but we see these two things in relative position to each other as on the same band that we've just been talking about with the critical, with the relationship to criticalness. The individual who adapts himself to the environment couldn't be critical of the environment at all. You see? He says, the environment's real and actual, and I just gotta fit myself in any round hole or square peg that comes along. You know? That's it. Now, societies have not progressed at the hands of such individuals. Anything that you have, like, or want in this society at this time is, to some degree, dependent upon the activities of individuals or yourself in adjusting the environment to themselves or yourself. Now, we see this, then, as a possible improvement that an individual who heretofore been lying supinely and letting the drill presses run across him, who has been, you know, kind of going along the traffic stream and hitting other cars and bouncing off those. That's the optimum personality in psychology, see? Drives along and adapts himself to the environment. That doesn't mean he drives along because of the other cars are driving along. The environment is there and he just chromes off various cars until he finally gets to a destination. Total adaption to environment. Now, we take this individual and we find out that we're not going to build much of a society with this fellow. And we're not going to build much of a society with this philosophy extant in it, because it's a sort of a piece of dry rot in the middle of an otherwise active civilization. This individual will it be as good as he can adapt the environment to himself or to his group. And we have a further thought which is entirely foreign to the Freudian school of thought, the psychological, which is an earlier, you know, psychology is older than psychoanalysis by many years. It practically went out just about the time psychoanalysis was coming in. And the school of thought of Freud and the earlier school of thought was built around an only one computation, where each person in the society thought of himself as the only one there. And the one dynamic, the urge toward survival, the first dynamic of self, was the only one which was recognized. And so the psychologist hears this statement, an individual is as good as he can adjust the environment to himself, and he says, oh, no. Horrible. That's going to fill a whole civilization full of maniacs. You see? See why he thinks that? Because his entire thought channel is along the line of the first dynamic. There's only one on earth. Each individual thinks of himself as just one, and there are no other individuals. This is a sort of a psychotic state which is accepted as normal. Now, we have to go upscale and examine the third dynamic before we can understand this, adjust the environment to oneself. And that's very easy to do when we adjust it to the third dynamic, because third dynamic is the urge toward survival of a group. And an individual being part of, or working with, or serving, or being served by a group is part and parcel to that group, works with that group. And each individual has within himself the potentiality and characteristic of being able to work as part of a group. And actually, a man is not very happy unless he can attain to some small group. Even the criminal has to have a gang. Now, when we think now of adjusting the environment, man has to adjust the environment to himself. We're not talking about him adjusting the environment to a bunch of only ones, whereby we would have continual conflict and fight, war amongst individuals. We're talking about man adjusting the environment to man. and we broadened it up to the fourth dynamic. Man has an urge to survive as man because he is a man and because there are men and individuals everywhere work in the direction, to some degree, of bettering man's survival. And each individual is working toward the bettering of the survival of the group toward which, with which he is involved. And a smaller group, a specialized group, comes under the second dynamic, the family. And he also, quite incidentally, works for individual survival when he's in pretty good shape. Because there's a joke back of all of this that we know in Dianetics and Scientology. We learned it in Scientology. This business about survival. How do you make an only one if it's this important to Fox this way? Because you see, it is important. Actually, the idea that we're all only ones, that every baby thinks of himself as the only baby on earth, this whole concept, although fallacious, would make it impossible for us to assume, if we believed, you see, this concept of only one, then it would make it impossible for us to accept that man is as well off as he can adjust the environment to him. You see, it'd be impossible to accept that. And the reason it'd be impossible to accept that is because you think of, gee whiz, I mean, you mean every truck driver I run into is trying to force the environment into the frame of reference of a truck driver. And every clerk I run into is trying to make the environment adjust itself to a clerk. And every other being that we run into is trying to adjust the environment to himself. And look at this, because obviously it can't work. It just won't work. And sure enough, if you think of the only one, it won't work. You see? So that psychology was never able to accept, and could not today even vaguely accept this idea. Let's take a little further look here and find out that an individual is at his best and is happiest when he is expressing the maximum number of dynamics in his beingness. Now, I'll tell you why this only one is a terrible joke. We do have some modern thinking. There's a great deal of very modern thinking in Dianetics and Scientology. Enough of it so that one indoctrinated in Dianetics and Scientology doesn't easily, at one swoop, communicate what he knows to somebody else. Because the other fellow thinks he knows a lot of things and that are very involved that aren't particularly true. And his belief that he knows all these things are enough to debar his acquiring any simplification of this entire catalog of knowingness. See, you get down here and you talk to a medico, and the medico has got tremendous catalogs of illnesses. And my goodness, there's illnesses and illnesses, and let's set that book there, that specialties on difficulties with toenails. Let's set that aside, and we go through this book, and we go through this, and it says this is specialties in the handling of scalpels. We set that aside, and we just accumulate this tremendous number of labels and facts, and we get over here and we get this book. And this is the number of parts there are in a brain from a medical man's standpoint. He thinks he knows something about the brain because he knows a lot of names. But his patient sits down, his patient is sick, the medico can't say abracadabra and so forth, and all of a sudden have the patient be happy about his illnesses. He can't do that. Well, then, why does he think he knows anything about the mind? He can't change it. But he has this huge battery of labels, and he's falling across these labels. They're a forest of swords. To get across this vast field would be impossible for him. So he just kind of sits down on the least sharp sword he finds and says, well, some specialist will have to know all about this. Well, that's an only one characteristic, isn't it? One of the finest specialists in the country, Dr. Pottinger, who is such an expert with TB that he's practically the only one you'd really go to in the United States if you had a bad case of TB. You'd go see Dr. Pottinger. And Dr. Pottinger would say, put his hands on your chest, and he'd say, oh, well, two spots already. Well, that's fine. We'll see if we can't do something about this. And he put you to bed, and then the next thing you know, you'd get well because you'd want to please him. That's right. People don't dare die around Doc Pottinger without upsetting him. But he is a great specialist. And he said to me one day in his office, there's only one trouble with medicine today. He said, there are more and more and more specialists, and more and more and more specialists, in more and more and more specialties. And he says, where in all this mass of specialties do we find somebody who knows something about sickness and medicine? That's quite a point. All right. Because every time you go to a specialist, he knows immediately that what you've got is his specialty. See? You walk in there, you see this fellow who is a specialist, what do they call him, phrenologist, specialist in fractured skulls. Anyway, you walk in to see this specialist in fractured skulls, and you've got a broken finger. You show him your broken finger, and he talks to you about your fractured skull. We don't get any place at all. He's a specialist. He expresses that specialty. If you have something wrong with you and you go to see a dentist, he'll tell you it can be cured by pulling out all your teeth. Doesn't that much matter what dentist or what malady, you'll get something of this expression. See more young people walking around without any teeth, and you say, well, what's the matter with you? The person says, I had arthritis. What's this got to do? Where'd you have the arthritis? I had it in my right leg. You can look in vain in people's right legs and you won't find any teeth. So, as we look over this, we have to examine this only one. It's the thing that drove a former attempt at formulating a science into the discard as far as practical use is concerned. It must be quite an important thing. Well, it is an important thing because we have everybody, if we had the idea that everybody was a separate individual and nobody was pulling with anybody else except under the duress, maybe of force or something, if we said there's no native desire to work together, we said there's no slightest compensation as being part of a group, we finally develop people. We would finally develop people so detached from reality and so far from any ability to understand their fellow man that they would actively contemplate the destruction of Earth and all creatures on it. Inevitable, isn't it? And we have developed such people. Now, there we got everybody getting more and more separate from everybody else, you see. Well, I won't say what role this philosophy called psychology has played in this, or what role psychoanalysis has played in this. It'd be impossible to estimate it. It might be just a sign of the time. But all these people have been taught this concept that the individual is as well off as he adjusts to his environment, and that individuality is the only thing an individual can express. In other words, we're all a bunch of only ones. And that is so improper that it doesn't work. And actually, if it is expressed continually, will drive men into madness. If you don't believe that sometimes, just take some little kid and keep insisting that he is much better than his fellows. He has more responsibility for himself because he is a member of this great family, and he has more responsibility than other children. And he is different than other children. And he has breeding, and he has talent, and he has to support these things. And he's got to realize that he is a junker. And junkers are all different. And they have something to support. And he has something to live for, you see, that's different than other boys. When he goes out there, he's slumming down in the alleyway when he's quite small before they break him of it entirely, and the kids are down there, and they're throwing mud at each other. And boy, he just gets mud from the top of his head to the tip of his toes, and they yank him inside, and they say, you mustn't play with these other boys because you're a junker. You're special. Now we get this family years later wondering why they have to take this kid to see a psychoanalyst who doesn't do anything for him. Why is the rich man's son raised in such an atmosphere, proverbially a difficult person? Why did they send Loeb and Leopold to prison? Except on the only one computation. They were telling them all the time. They were telling them all the time, you're just one, you're just one, you're just one, you're something special, you're something different, you're not like other boys, you mustn't be part of that group. And what did this do to these people? A man is eight dynamics alive. That's how alive a man is. He is eight dynamics alive. There are eight urges toward survival, as we subdivide them in Scientology, and these eight urges toward survival are self. Urge to survive as self. Urge to survive through sex and the raising of children and the supporting and continuance of family. The urge toward survival as groups, and that's any kind of a group. And the urge toward survival just as a man. The urge to survival for all men on the part of one man, you see. And the urge toward survival as simply life forms. The urge of a life form to survive. And then the urge toward survival for this universe, which is space, energy, matter, time, just that it should survive. And then the urge toward survival of spiritual things, or spirits, if you wish. And finally, the urge toward survival of infinity, which is the eighth dynamic, which is an infinity turned on its side. We could call it a supreme being if we wanted to. But here we have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. And just imagine now that we had 8 rods up here, each one of them just this tall. And we had this as their full total height. An individual would be as alive as he had all of these rods. And then we come along and we say, you're the only one. And we put his attention over here on number one. And we have immediately blurred out some portion of the remainder. It would take a great deal of punishment. It would take an awful lot of duress to much knock down these other rods. But man manages it. Now, his family keeps saying, you're different. Or you've got to behave, or the group isn't for you, and so on. What are they doing to him? They're killing him. It isn't that the individual also has a third dynamic, the dynamic of group. He is natively possessed of this dynamic, and it is part of the life which he experiences. And when we take that and diminish it, or pull it out of his makeup, or blunt it, or dull it, we have made him that much less alive. If a man were totally alive, this would be impossible. But if a man were totally alive on the first dynamic and no other dynamic existed of any kind whatsoever, he would be 1/8 alive. You see that? 1/8. And things would look 1/8 as bright to him. And that wall over there would be 1/8 as real as it should be. And therefore he would have 1/8 the responsibility that he should have. And therefore, like criminals like Leopold and Loeb that now get written about in the Saturday Evening Post and this aberrated society, one of the cheaper journals, Saturday Evening Post, but it did have a good artist drawing for it one time or another. But the Saturday Evening Post has given 4 installments to a couple of fellows who have benefited man to the degree of killing a small boy as a sex crime. I don't think it can call itself a magazine anymore to me. Because if in that they have given data and material that would prevent this from occurring or would better such circumstances in the future, then there'd be some sense to it. But all it is a maudlin steering of so-called facts to titillate the appetite of the reader. Now, these boys being totally responsible for self, let us say they were 100% responsible for self. This would be impossible, but let's just say they were. They would have
no responsibility for any other man, dog, cat, or object, or moment, being, spirit, anything in the whole universe, you would then have accomplished a horrible monster. A monster. Nothing less. And so, individuals who are driven back to this line can occasionally accomplish monstrous things. It is only when the third dynamic is taken away that crime can even vaguely arise. Only then can crime take place. We examine the criminal, we find out in all of his various departments, he is the bringer of death. That's all. That's his total gift, death. Not a very happy frame of mind to be in. And he's a very unhappy person. Now, when we break it down to only a first dynamic, we have broken it down as well, the broken down the first dynamic, to where what is granted and what is grantable is death, and nothing else is grantable. Nice view, isn't it? If we went ahead and worked on this philosophy of man being an individual only and without any feeling for his fellows, no responsibility for them, that every man was thinking about himself and for himself forever, if we went ahead and specialized on this, we brought up all of our children to believe this, we would finally achieve a society of criminals. Only when Rome had achieved this philosophy did it die. Rome had achieved this philosophy at the turn of 2 millennia ago. They were perfectly willing to see their fellow men torn into pieces by wild beasts in an arena. Bunch of only ones. They were crazy, these people. They were very unhappy. And these insane people had an empire which had been built for them by sane people. And then the same people had gotten so they felt better than the rest of the people on earth. And there was only one thing you could possibly be, and that was a Roman, and all other things were despicable. So the Roman became a sort of a first dynamic as a Roman, you see. And he fell away from his companionship with the rest of the races on earth. And falling away from that, he fell away from the third dynamic of being a Roman. And at last was simply a mob of criminals. Now, the sad history of Rome wouldn't be called sad to anyone who had been around in those days and had had a couple of lions nibbling upon him in an arena. People felt strongly about this. They felt strongly enough about this to overthrow that entire empire. In other words, how do we bring an empire up to a level where it can be overthrown? How do we bring it up to a point where it can be overthrown? We just teach everybody in it to be an individual who has no responsibility for any other individual. We make nothing but specialists in the sciences. We do not teach anyone who is in the field of physics any of the humanities. We don't teach anyone in the humanities any of the exact sciences. You get the idea? We turn out engineers who have no more command of the King's English. They you say Macbeth, and they say, I heard of that in high school. Yeah, Macbeth, I heard of that in high school. It was written by somebody. Yeah, I well remember. I remember I had to memorize something from Macbeth. Just a minute, I'll remember it here just a moment. The quality of mercy is not strained. Yeah, I remember. These people have no feeling for the arts at all. They can become extremely engrossed because they're specialists. They're engineers. They're beyond such things as these human impulses. Now, we give them some laboratories and let them build weapons to blow up more sections of Earth than they could build. I know I asked one day, I saw a section of desert, pretty nice desert, that got blown up by an atom bomb, and I said, by the way, just offhand, could you blow up another section like that? And the fellow says, yeah, yeah, we could blow up a whole town. And I said, well, that's very interesting. I said, could you build one? I made him sick. He got sick. when I deal with these boys, ordinarily I don't much believe in pulling the punches. I don't think the government itself has any real thought in this direction. But here we have an unbalanced education being handed out to a great many people. Be all very well if people in the humanities understood a little bit more about the exact sciences. It's quite laughable to ask somebody in the humanities. He says, well, what we really need on this job is a statistician. And what he means by a statistician is somebody who can add columns and average them in some fashion or another. A statistician would be so much more than they demand of him if you really looked at what a statistician could do, that he'd take a long time doing it. They say, well, we're using a scientific methodology in doing this. If you took the scientific methodology out of the humanities and tried to apply it to engineering, nothing would happen. Trains would not run. Tunnels would all collapse. Buildings would all fall down. And there'd be nothing but solid bacteria in your city water systems. They have no real appreciation of it. But similarly, and unfortunately, the engineer has very, very little knowledge of the humanities. Very little. He's a pauper when it comes to this. Unless a society has more broad feelings for itself, unless it has within itself some common denominator of interest, it starts falling apart into a bunch of only one characteristics. And what happens then? What happens? You get dark ages. That's what happens, because everything goes out of communication. All right, let's look at this on a happier side. Let's look at it on a nice, happy side. What do we mean by these dynamics? We mean the total assembly of possible communications. Now, let's just revamp your whole idea right now of dynamics. It isn't some urge that is expressed by a small arrow going through your head. It is not something that is on a graph and in your pocket. It is a desire to survive in a certain direction and sphere of action. That's what a dynamic is. But much more important than that, let's just consider it as a lot of possible communications. Now, the funny part of it is you're as well off as you're in communication. That's interesting, isn't it? We can prove that. We have a triangle in Scientology called the triangle, the AIC triangle. You'll see Scientology, and we sign their letters, something of the sort, with ARC, Bob, or something like that. What's he mean? He means affinity, reality, communication, and this triangle itself sums up to understanding. Do you think if the whole world understood everything else in the world, that any part of the world would hate any other part of the world? If all parts of the world understood every part of the world, could there be any hate in the world at all? No, there sure couldn't be. There sure couldn't be. Understanding is composed of affinity, reality, and communication. And these three factors, combined one with another, are themselves life. The potentialities and characteristics of life are contained in these three things. What do we mean by affinity? Actually, we mean the consideration of distance between communicating points. That is what we mean by affinity. But it's how much, it's an engineering definition, if you please, for love. Now, here we have all of the various emotions, efforts, and so forth, all lump under affinity. Now we have over here reality. How real, how actual are these things? In other words, how much are we agreed upon these things? And over here we have C, which is communication. The ability to exchange ideas concerning actualities with affinities. We can't exchange ideas or communicate in the absence of some agreement, in the absence of some liking or affinity. You see, we have to have liking or affinity of some kind, and we have to have agreement of some kind in order to have communication. And we can demonstrate in Scientology that the only universal solvent there is communication. That's really a universal solvent. It does the darndest thing. It's the most remarkable thing there is. You handle communication while you're processing somebody, and it is the, It is utterly fantastic. It is an actual scientific miracle which occurs when you apply correctly communication processing to an individual. What communication can do for a person is demonstrated in the fact that when not enough communication is done, it can make him sick. Now, that's an oddity, isn't it? Let's take an individual who has theoretically no communication, and he's sort of lying there like a rock, you know? There's no communication at all, and all of a sudden somebody says three words to him. See? Like, you darn fool. And he says, boy, look at this. Look what I got here. I have some sense and meaning from an exterior source. And man, is this precious. I'm now going to dedicate my life to being a darn fool. Now, that's actually the operation of the image pictures which a person has. The communication is so scarce that he picks it up and hugs it to his psychic bosom forevermore. And he won't let go of it until you or an auditor comes along and says, how are you, Joe? How are you, Joe? Well, that's fine. I'm glad you're feeling good. Fine. How are you, Joe? How are you, Joe? How are you, Joe? Well, hello, Joe. Okay, Joe. How are you, Joe? And the fellow will say, you know, I don't feel like being a darn fool now. I'm Joe. All right. Here we have something so powerful that just a few drops of it, completely different than medicine. Medicine, if you use a quart, will probably kill somebody, but if you use a teaspoonful, it'll probably help them. That's strychnine, you know. You take a spoonful of strychnine, and it actually will help somebody. Bad heart or something of the sort. Nitroglycerin. Another thing, they take a spoonful of nitroglycerin, they get away with it. But if they take a quart, they don't dare belch. Well, it's quite the reverse with communication. Quite the reverse. You give somebody a small measuring spoonful of communication. And he says, oh, no good. And generally, that's about all there is available in a society that's starting to go out of communication with itself. You know, a very inadequate spoonful. The last time you were driving down the road and another driver said, well, sure, swell day, isn't it? Last time you did this was quite a long time ago, isn't it, huh? You're driving down the road, and the driver in another car leaned out, even at the stop sign, and he said, hey, isn't it a nice day? That's such a small dose that it would have re-stimulated you into believing he was crazy. You would have gone driving on down the road thinking, I wonder what was wrong with him. All right. Communication, quite important in communication to have some basis of agreement. In other words, some similarity so that we can talk. We at least have to know the same language, don't we? In order to talk, of course, there are other types of communication than talking, but if we don't know at least the language, why, we have a hard time getting along. I have talked to people whose language I didn't know, and it's been fairly successful at, but at least from my viewpoint. At least I got the chop suey and so forth. I didn't starve to death. But the point is we have a common thing like language when we can communicate. You see this? All right, now look at here. Here's this fellow who is all up here on the first dynamic and no other dynamic. He's going to be having a hard time with his language, isn't he? Well, what's this about the medico with his huge book which has all the nomenclature about the mind? And he tells us about our autonomic nervous systems, our jula oblongatas. And even a Scientologist says to him, huh? And the fellow says, well, it's very simple. It's very simple why she's crazy. Her autonomic nervous system is cross-ruffed with a deuce of spades. And he diagnosed, pages, textbooks, looks it up, marks all the places, makes a complete analysis, turns in a report twice as big as the book of names, and the person is still sick. Why? Because he's not communicating on the subject of that person's illness. He's just communicating on a one-terminal basis. There's nobody else listening. That's a one-terminal communication. A bunch of labels, and he understands them, the patient doesn't. Of course, you can't impress a patient this way, but you don't make them well. Why? Because there's no communication. It takes communication to make a patient well. There's many a fine old medico sitting out in the sticks. Amy Glutz comes in. She says, I got that misery again. And he says, where you got it? And she says, right where it always is. You darn fool, it's right where it always is. Where's the medicine? And he says, well, now, I don't know. I don't know. You sure been taking an awful lot of this scotch I've been giving you, Amy. And she says, well, it is pretty bad. And he says, well, all right. Pretty bad. And here's a prescription for a pint and a medicine bottle. And she says, well, okay. So on. He knew her. See? She knew him. They could talk. Amy finally goes to town to live with her daughter, who married very well, and she gets this craving, and she goes down to see a Park Avenue specialist, and she winds up in the Mayo Clinic, and they take her stomach out. She didn't quite know how this happened. She went into a Park Avenue doctor's office. They said the fellow was a good doctor, but she didn't see the doctor. She saw a nurse. Saw some other nurses, and then she saw some technicians, and then they took some x-rays, and then she saw some more technicians. She never got a chance to talk to anybody. These people just went around silently clicking the handles on machines. She hopes somebody's going to say something somewhere along the line. She finally gets to the Mayo Clinic, wakes up out of the ether. Nobody to talk to there either. Get the idea? No communication. You know, I remember a little kid that was screaming and hollering one time. Screaming and hollering and having an awful tantrum. Oh, he was just having a wing-ding. Brutal time. There was company present. We were the company. And he was just screaming and throwing his heels. And so I went over to him and I asked, who do you want attention from? Kid looked at me and said, you? I said, well, you got it. So he shut up. Some understanding. Get the idea? Now, if we made a world of specialists, each one of whom understood completely that he was the only one there was, we would have a world of non-communication, wouldn't we? And so that world could hate. That world could go to war with itself. And that world could be sick because it would be at best only one-eighth alive. So let's look at these dynamics, these various urges toward survival, and let's see in these dynamics an opportunity to communicate. In each dynamic, there's an opportunity to communicate. Even in the first dynamic, there was more opportunity to communicate than modern man, but not ancient man, had supposed. There's this thing called exteriorization. Whoever thought that a fellow could be 3 feet back of his own head? We weren't talking about mysticism, magic, psychic souls, or something, a large bunch of vias. We just said to somebody one day, be 3 feet back of your head, and he was. His body was sitting there, and he as a personality was 3 feet back of his head. The usefulness of this was tremendous, but it demonstrated to us that we had never scraped the bottom on the first dynamic. We were there then. That was the first time we had hit the first dynamic. Because man himself, as he sits there and talks to you, or stands there and talks to you, is a composite being. Of course, there's some part of him in control of the other parts of him for him to be sane or rational. But at the same time, he is not one talking to you. A lot of people get inverted on this, and they talk about saving their soul. You call that religion. You get the idea? A fellow saves his soul. How could you save your soul if you were your soul? It would be puzzling, wouldn't it? Well, they've been puzzled about it for a long time. If you don't believe they've been puzzled about it, try and get a rational explanation out of some of the earlier religions, like the Maasai witch doctor or something of the sort. Now, here we have, then, a picture where the actual anatomy of the individual had not been fully understood. Instead of, as psychiatry has a tendency to believe, psychoanalysis kind of believed. Oh, psychoanalysis believed in a populated skull, oh, by the way. There was this basic, barbaric, bestial fellow, and then there was the censor, and there was a heavy population in the first manic. I beg your pardon. It was overcrowded, in fact. There was the unconscious, the reconscious, and the bounce effect. Oh, no, that's, pardon me, that's in metaphysics. That's a report between two ghouls who have been ostracized. A bounce effect. All nonsense. But we found that the individual himself was not one. See, as he stood there, this being with a body and so forth, he was not one. Psychiatry had so far believed that he was one that he thought he was a machine. See? He was kind of something like a biological hurdy-gurdy or something that went round and round and shuffled out thoughts like you shuffle a deck of cards. Very early, I was researching in the field of electronic brains, and I was singularly struck with a very great oddity that the moment an operator walked away from the brain, it stopped computing. He'd take his fingers off of it, and it'd shut up. And so I communicated this to some of my fellows in the field of physics and so forth. And I said, you know, it's a funny thing. I said, you know, when you stop running, one of the things quits. And one of them said, oh, you think so? And he took me over and showed me an ENIAC, first time I'd seen an ENIAC close up. And he said, you see? And he threw on the switch, and it just sat there, and it ran, and it ran, and it ran, and it shuffled things. And we walked out of the room. We came back, and it was still hunting in its card files and still tabulating over here and so on. And this engineer was standing there saying, you see, that's a man after all. He's just a big machine. Doesn't matter whether you do anything to him or not. He really doesn't hurt. You know, he's just a machine. It's sort of a biological, like a vegetable. And this is the kind of a thing that's his brain, and this is what we ought to be studying. He was giving me this big explanation. We went in the other room. We had a couple of drinks, and I asked the fellow. I said, who is the machine giving its answer to? That was tough. That was one second-hand engineer. I made a citizen out of him right there. Well, now, many years afterwards, I actually found who the brain, if it ever did compute anything, was giving its answers to. Giving his answers to the person that you talk to. But this person is being a body or being a brain. So he says, I am a body or brain. He only has to change his mind, say, I'm not a body or brain, be 3 feet back here. And he's back here. He's mixed up in machinery. He can think of his own answers. He doesn't have to get them off the computer. In other words, there was an operator on this machine all the time, identifying the operator and so forth, and knowing what he is and what he is doing and what he is made of is definitely the business of the Scientologist. In other words, the Scientologist is no longer working with machinery. He is working with the operators of machinery. And the sooner he begins to realize that a machine is as good as it has operators, and no better, why, he begins to be very successful. A lot of people around in Dianetics are still working on the basis that the machine is all you have to repair. I remember one time we fixed up a racing car. Boy, we shined it all up and, you know, adjusted it and tuned it up and put in new spark plugs. And, oh, man, I mean, that thing just purr, you know, purr. And we're sitting there waiting to go around the track, and the driver came out. And the driver had been kind of nerved up just before the race, so a buddy of his had slipped him a couple, you know, a couple off the hip. Fellow bent his elbow quite liberally, and he came over and tried to get in the car image. We got him over and got him behind the wheel, and you know he didn't win the race. It was the best car there. But the driver was half the time trying to drive through the grandstand.
If the car had been loosed up, though, and if you'd just taken the car around the track, you know, and turned on its throttle real good and let it go, it would have gone into the grandstand for sure. So a drunk driver was better than no driver, wasn't it? All right. When we look all this over, we find out that the goal of man is not necessarily to be an unconscious, impulsive part of all the things that are. That's not a good goal for a man. You know, sort of run by everything. But a perfect knowing part of and participant in any and all of the functions of life when an individual is so capable that he can associate without any fear on his own part and without any slightest qualms with any part of existence. He's got all eight dynamics going, and they're all in communication. And if you had a race of men like that, you wouldn't have any specialists. You'd have a civilization. Thank you.